We were saddened to learn last week of the deaths of Barbara Carroll and Barbara Gelb. Barbara Carroll, who was often introduced as the First Lady of Jazz Piano, visited our show in 2004 when she paid tribute to Harold Arlen. And Barbara Gelb is best known for her biographies of Eugene O'Neill. I spoke with her and her husband Arthur Gelb in 2000 when they were on the show to discuss their second biography of Eugene O'Neill, O'Neill: Life with Monte Cristo. For our bonus weekend podcast, we're bringing you both of those interviews. And as an additional tribute to Barbara Gelb, we're also replaying my interview in 2016 with Jessica Lange, Gabriel Byrne, and Michael Shannon about the Roundabout Theater Company's production of Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Into Night. Enjoy.
Driving me crazy. What did I do? What did I do? My tears for you make everything hazy, clouding those skies of blue. How dear were the friends who were near me to cheer me. Believe me, they knew that you.
I'm Leonard Lope. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. What you noticed first about Barbara Carroll when she's seated at the piano is her smile. She seems excited to be there. But it's a place she should feel quite comfortable at by now. During a career that spans over 50 years, she has jammed with the likes of Charlie Parker and Stan Getz and can include Frank Sinatra, Lena Horne, Tony Bennett, and Dinah Washington among her admirers. These days, she is playing an open-ended gig at the Algonquin Hotel's Oak Room on Sundays at 2 and 8 p.m., and she has a new recording, Barbara at Birdland, all of which gives me a chance to catch up with her today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
Do you feel the Algonquin is a good place to play this kind of music?
I feel it's a perfect place to play this kind of music. It's intimate. It's so comfortable to be there. I just adore it. And, of course, the hotel has such history associated with it that makes me feel good just to walk into the lobby.
You even do a couple of songs with lyrics by Dorothy Parker.
I do. You know, I didn't know until a couple of years ago that Dorothy Parker had written lyrics for songs. But I remember hearing these songs that I do recorded by Billie Holiday many years ago. One was Oh, How Am I to Know, which has music by Jack King. And the other is Wished on the Moon, which has music by Ralph Ranger. But when I heard Billie Holiday's records of these songs, I never knew that the lyrics were by Dorothy Parker.
And now you might even feel that she's in the room with you on all of those ghosts of the Algonquin Round Table.
You know, it's interesting that you should say that, because believe me, sometimes when I'm playing there, I do feel the spirit of Miss Parker in those walls and all those fabulous, brilliant lunchers who congregated there every day to trade witticisms and have a little lunch. And, of course, they were the Algonquin Round Table, or the Vicious Circle, as they were known.
But when you began performing in New York, it was a very different kind of a scene. Nobody would have performed at the Algonquin. It was 52nd Street, wasn't it?
Well, I came to New York at the end of the 52nd Street era, but I was fortunate that I got here before 52nd Street was finished. You see, by the early 1950s, it was all over. But when I got here, you could go to 52nd Street on any given night and hear Miles Davis, Charlie Parker, Art Tatum, Billie Holiday, Dizzy Gillespie, et cetera, you know. It was just heaven.
Just walk down the street and
just
walk into different clubs.
Just walk down the street. One club, the Three Deuces, the Onyx Club, the Downbeat Club, et cetera, et cetera. And it was just fabulous. And, of course, I felt as if I was in heaven, because there I was in New York City, surrounded by the music, the musicians, the singers that I absolutely idolized.
Well, during the swing era, and especially during World War II, there were a lot of women who were playing jazz. But when modern jazz came in, I can't think of any women except vocalists who were prominent. Was there discrimination against women? What was it like for you?
Well, you know, when I began playing, I was so immersed in the music. I wanted to play so very much that I never thought about the fact that it would be difficult for me because I was female. So that didn't occur to me, and I went blindly straight ahead, not realizing that there was discrimination. Of course there was. But, you know, it's interesting because musicians are very tolerant people. So you sort of had to prove yourself to the musicians, you know. If they felt that you could play, then it was okay for the chick piano player to sit in, you know, that kind of thing.
She plays as good as a guy.
Well, that's what they used to say. Gee, you play like a man, or you play good for a girl.
At the same time, it had to be a bit intimidating to find yourself playing at the same club that Art Tatum was playing at.
That happened to me one time. The first time I played at the Embers, which was a marvelous club on East 54th Street in New York City. They always had two attractions there, and I was there with my trio, and we were supposed to work opposite Art Tatum. Well, you know, that was like appearing opposite God.
Mm-hmm. Fats Waller called him God. He said, God is in the house when Art Tatum showed up.
Absolutely. So, you know, Art Tatum would play his absolutely fabulous set, and I would have to go on and play after him. You can imagine what that was like, but he was very, very, very encouraging and very sweet to me. I must say it was an experience I'll never forget.
I understand another time you were at a New Year's Eve party, and it was Count Basie and Dave Brubeck.
That was a great party. That was a party held at Dorothy Kilgallen's home. In one room, they had the Dave Brubeck Quartet. In another room, they had Count Basie with a five-piece band. And I was in the library with my trio. Well, you know, it doesn't get much more exciting than that. But the high point of the evening for me was about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Judy Garland came in and sat on the piano bench and sang. I mean, I will never forget that. And she sang, you know, The Man That Got Away and Over the Rainbow and all those. I couldn't believe that she was sitting there next to me. It was really thrilling.
Well, the songs from The Wizard of Oz were written by Harold Arlen, who was a friend of yours. And we're celebrating his centennial year, aren't we?
Yes, coming up.
Next year.
2005. As a matter of fact, when I go back to the Algonquin on January 30th, I'm going to be doing part of the show is going to be a tribute to Harold Arlen. Because of the fact that he was born 100 years ago. I did know him. And once I was really excited because he was about to record his first vocal. He was a marvelous singer, I must say, that he sang better than most of the singers he wrote for. He had sort of a cantorial style because his father was a cantor, and also Harold was very influenced by blues and music such as Count Basie's band and the old Lunsford band, and he loved jazz. So it was a combination of those two influences that made him the spectacular singer that he was.
He wrote two standards that have the word blues in the title, Blues in the Night, and I Got a Right to Sing the Blues.
You bet.
And, not bad.
And a lot of other songs that he wrote were very blues-influenced.
Stormy Weather, he wrote Stormy Weather.
Absolutely.
And that old Black Magic and The Man That Got Away. And but one of the ones that always stuns me is he wrote Get Happy, which is, I always think of as being from a very different kind of mindset.
But you see how monumental his talent was, that he was able to do both. He was able to write happy songs and blues songs and torch songs. And he was just fabulous. And I was privileged to know him, and as I said, he was going to record an album. In those days, they were albums, not CDs, and he wanted to sort of do a demo of what he was going to record before the actual recording session. So he asked me to go into the studio and play for him while he recorded these songs. Well, you know, there's nothing more intimidating than playing a composer's songs for the composer. So I was really scared, but I did it, and it came out pretty well. And what a thrill it was to hear him singing his own compositions.
Did it give you insight when you started singing later?
Oh, I think that he was probably an influence on me. I think everyone that you hear that you like is an influence on you.
My guest is Barbara Carroll, who's playing twice on Sundays at the Algonquin Hotel's Oak Room. That's at 59 West 44th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues. A brunch show at 2 p.m. and a dinner show at 8 p.m. And she has a new recording called Barbara at Birdland, which was recorded live at another one of New York's wonderful jazz rooms. That's from Harbinger Records. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Well, today we think of you as a singer who accompanies herself. In fact, a profile in The Sun says legendary jazz songbird nests at Oak Room. But you didn't start singing until rather late in the career. You were a pianist. Were you inspired at all by Nat King Cole or people like that? Or were you just who also started as a pianist and then started singing?
Exactly. You know, I love the word songbird applied to me because I consider myself a pianist who sings. You know, there is some sort of discrimination there, but
and you have a bass player, Jay Lenhart, who's Jay a Lenhart. Bass player who sings.
Jay Lenhart is the best. He and I are working at the Algonquin, and we're having such a good time. He's a marvelous songwriter, as you know, a wonderful singer. So we really have a lot of fun. This CD is was made at Birdland Live last year, and I had Jay Lenhart and a terrific drummer named Joe Cacuzzo. So it was a great thrill to do that record. And, you know, when you do something live, there is an element of spontaneity. There's a certain feeling that I love. I love live recordings. On the other hand, they're difficult in the sense that you can't improve them after you finish the recording as you can in a studio. You know, it's much more difficult to fool around with the record.
On the other hand, there are those nights, I'm sure, where you say to yourself, gee, I wish there was some recording equipment in this club right now because everything is just coming together.
Absolutely.
Or somebody comes and sits in with you and you say, oh my God, this is going to be lost. Only the people in this room even know about it.
It happens time and time again, but those are the chances you take with live performance.
So tell me how you got started. You probably, like everybody else, learned to play classical music first.
No.
No?
No. I got started because we had a piano at home. When I was about 5 years old, I gravitated to the piano. And I used to hear things on the radio and play them and, you know, and little compositions of my own. So I wanted to study, but I had two older sisters who had been given piano lessons and violin lessons and all kinds of lessons. And, you know, they didn't want to practice the usual routine. So my parents, I was a good deal younger than they. And my parents were very disenchanted with the idea of any more music lessons. So by the time I came along, they said, no, you know. So I sort of had to beg. But by the time I was 8 years old, they said, okay, you can study piano, and only if you practice and pay attention. Well, they didn't have to beg me to do that because I was so fascinated with the whole idea. And I began studying classical music when I was about eight. I studied maybe for 7 years or so. But meanwhile, in that period of time, I heard Nat Cole, and I heard Art Tatum and Teddy Wilson and those people, and it was as if a light went on, you know, because I said, aha, that's what I want to do.
And then when you reached the point where you were playing professionally, modern jazz was in effect, and you had assimilated all of those developments as well?
Well, then there were influences such as Thelonious Monk, Bud Powell, you know, all those wonderful pianists. And later on, Oscar Peterson, Bill Evans. So there were many influences. My first influence was Nat Cole. When he was a pianist. When I heard Nat Cole play, that was really a very important moment in my life. And he was a brilliant pianist and, of course, a marvelous singer.
So how do you develop your own style after you hear all these other people?
Well, you just do what you feel, I suppose. What else can you do?
You also appeared on Broadway in Me and Juliet.
Oh, my. I was legitimate, yes.
That's Rodgers and Hammerstein. Mm-hmm. But how did you wind up singing? I know you quit the business for a while when you had a daughter. And then when you came back, you weren't playing jazz anymore, didn't you? Weren't you an accompanist for Rita Coolidge?
Oh, that was just for one record. That happened because my husband was the manager of Chris Christopherson and Rita Coolidge.
Who were married at the time.
They were married, yes. And Rita and I were very friendly, and so we used to fool around at home, and she would sing, and I taught her some songs, you know, some standard songs that she didn't know, because essentially she was singing country music at that time. She's a marvelous singer. So we made a record for A&M Records. I thought it was pretty good. They thought that it was too jazzy, that it was too jazz-influenced, and they never put it out. Many years later, it came out in Japan. So I guess it is around in some form or other.
If you can read Japanese, you probably will know exactly what was performed and right. Who was on the record date. You do sound wonderful when you sing. So had you always sung, or is this something that you just fell into, like Nat King Cole?
I always knew a lot of lyrics. I always knew the words to everything, but I was afraid to sing because I felt I didn't have the vocal equipment and, you know, I couldn't sustain the notes properly, so forth and so on. So I didn't really begin singing until I began performing at the Bellman's Bar at the Carlisle.
Not the best room to perform in.
No, it was not. It had certain disadvantages, such as noise and smoke in those days. Everybody was smoking. But you see, I was playing solo piano there, and sometimes when you're a solo pianist, people come over to you and say, gee, do you know the words to that? Would you sing that? And so I got a lot of that kind of conversation and finally decided, why, I'll just give it a shot. You know, since I did know the words to everything, I was just chicken about doing it.
Well, you not only know the words, you know all the intros. You seem to be, you insist on doing the intro rather than just jumping into a song.
Oh, I think that really sets up the song, don't you?
Yeah, oh, I do. And it's always, often it's wonderful to hear what the composer intended before we get into the more recognizable melody.
Well, actually, the verse of the song is sort of an explanation of what the song is about, you know. And I think it's very important to do that, give people an idea of what the song means.
What happens when you look out in the audience and you see a Frank Sinatra or a Billie Holiday? Does that make it a little scarier?
Sometimes, of course. Absolutely.
And that's
absolutely.
Or somebody like Tony Bennett.
Oh, Tony, dear Tony, is a good friend of mine. And occasionally he has come in to hear me at different places. He came to the Algonquin not so long ago, and he's gotten up to sing a song or two. And it's always a thrill. And, of course, the audience goes crazy.
How do you pick the songs that you do? You know, some of them are really well-known, but you always like a few less famous, wonderful songs. I'm thinking of something like Dancing on the Ceiling by Rodgers and Hart. Mm-hmm.
I pick songs that I like, and that's the only criterion for my doing a song.
Is it the same every night?
No. Oh, gosh, no. I change songs all the time. I couldn't do the same show every night. That would be a big bore to me.
Although there are a lot of people who insist on that.
It's okay. I mean, if you have a set show and you do that, that's just fine. I don't work that way. I try to change very frequently.
You knew Harold Arlen, you said. Other composers as well?
My dear friend Cy Coleman, unfortunately,
He was here just a month before he died.
Really?
Yeah, he was right before he went into Feinstein's. And he was just so wonderful and so lively. It was stunned when I saw that he died.
He was so marvelous. You know, Bobby Short, after Cy died, Bobby Short sent me a photograph that was taken at Bobby's 80th birthday party at the Rainbow Room just about a month before Cy passed away. And I was thrilled to get it because Cy was one of my favorite people. I had known him for many years. I met him when I first came to New York. He had a trio. I had a trio. We played a lot of the same rooms. He was a fabulous, a really sensational pianist.
Barbara Carroll is playing on Sundays at the Algonquin Hotel's Oak Room at 59 West 44th Street, a brunch show at 2 p.m. and a dinner show at 8 p.m. For reservations, you can give them a call at 212-419-0331. There's also the new album called Barbara at Birdland. Live at Birdland from Harbinger Records, and we'll go out with a little bit from Do I Hear a Waltz. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Author and Barbara Gelb collaborated on a landmark biography of Eugene O'Neill back in 1962, but that doesn't mean that they stopped their research. As a matter of fact, they've uncovered so much new information on our leading playwright's early life in the intervening decades that they've come out with a new work called O'Neill, Life with Monte Cristo for Applause Books. Arthur Gelb is a former managing editor of the New York Times, and Barbara Gelb is a freelance writer and lecturer on the theater, and I'm delighted to have them both with me now on New York and Company to discuss what they've unearthed. Hello.
Hello, thank you.
You've written that Stephen Spender was astonished when you told him that you were actually rewriting your biography of O'Neill. He said, no biographer ever does that. That would be tantamount to admitting that he didn't get it right the first time.
He cited one exception, Michael Holroyd, who did the Lytton Strachey biography. That he said that was the only time
he rewrote the Lytton Strachey biography. He rewrote it.
Yes.
But what often happens is I will have a biographer come in and say, well, why have you written a book about O'Neill when the Gelbs did such an important work 30 years ago? And the answer will be, well, so much has come out since then. Is that your answer?
That is exactly the answer, yes. I mean, someone else would have done it probably sooner or later, and we thought, well, we should do it.
But wasn't the complaint, people loved the book, they called it a classic, but wasn't the only complaint was that some people felt it was too comprehensive?
Yes, they
well,
did.
Well, there were some complaints about that, I think, wrongly. But there has been a tremendous amount of new research done, as you say. New research has been available. And so we thought that we could not just leave the book the way it was.
We also feel that there's no such thing as being too comprehensive if your research is good and if your writing is clear. People who are interested in your subject will want to read as much as you can give them in a...
Well, you have to be selective up to a point, certainly. Yes. You don't give them everything.
But what about getting it right? Do you feel, in retrospect, that... you were young when you wrote the O'Neill book, and you had
exactly.
a different take on things than you might
yes,
have had
absolutely.
Now?
Absolutely. That's one of the main points, one of the main reasons why we have rewritten it. Yes. We're getting it righter this time.
Because you're different people now.
Yes,
but O'Neill is the same person,
yes,
isn't he?
Yes, but we're much more mature, and we have, when we wrote the book, we had young children. Now we have grandchildren. We view life differently, and our culture has changed, too. And we are much more sympathetic, for example, to O'Neill's parents than we were when we originally did our research. We feel that they have been somewhat maligned by O'Neill himself as well as his brother.
In other words, buying what O'Neill tells us in Long Day's Journey and Tonight is unfair to his parents.
It's artistically fair. It's his artistic vision comes first.
You can't say it's unfair because it's a play and he dramatizes it and he makes it what he wants to make it. But biographically, we felt that we could be more sympathetic to the parents now because O'Neill and his brother really were rather ne'er-do-wells for early parts of their lives and were supported by his father. And he was very unsympathetic to the fact that they didn't do anything and his father supported them.
But what does this say about the nature of biography? If the same people who've looked at a life at a certain point come to disagree with what they said earlier. I'm not talking about the new letters and the other things.
No,
I'm talking about just the whole take
life. But it does have to do with new material and new revelations. But it's history is revised constantly, isn't it?
And the disagreements are subtle. They're not earth-shaking disagreements. We wanted very much in this biography to deeply probe O'Neill's father's poverty, because as you know, it's mentioned in Long Day's Journey and Tonight
as the reason for all of his
for his
terribleness,
his parsimoniousness, and also his what he is blamed for doing to O'Neill's mother and to his brother and himself.
That led her to become a drug addict.
That's one of the reasons. So we decided for this biography to our own powers of reporting, to go back to Ireland and to research as carefully as we were able to do the world in which James O'Neill, O'Neill's father, was born, which was during the Great Famine, and how it affected him. He was so terrified of what he saw around him, the poorhouses all over Ireland, and how people were starving and had to eat rats in some cases.
I think we've given a much more rounded psychological portrait of James O'Neill now, and it's very important because that was the main influence on O'Neill and on his plays and, you know, on his whole career and on his whole attitude.
So we discovered for the first time where O'Neill's father, no one knew where O'Neill's father was born. They knew Ireland, but no one knew where the actual town was, the village. We have discovered the village of Tinnaranny.
You find it?
Well, through there's a man, a retired farmer named Brian O'Neill, who lives in that village and is a
distant relative
of the O'Neill family. Right. And he started, he read our biography years ago, and he started making his own search and found the record, the birth record, in the local church of O'Neill's father's birth. It was the first time that anyone has pinpointed that birth. And from there, we were able to go way beyond the record and into the kind of life O'Neill's father led, how the family came over on a ship called India to Buffalo, where poverty was even worse than it was in Ireland. And the Irish were treated miserably, as mm-hmm. you know. They lived in the worst kind of hovels in Buffalo. And that's what O'Neill's father was brought up in.
Now, when you started all of this, did you think you were revising the original book, or did you know from the start that you were going to write a whole new biography?
No, we didn't know from the start. We thought we were just revising. We sort of were picking up little things that had come to our attention over the years. And then we started doing a little more research and realizing more and more stuff had come, you know, that was available. And ultimately, we decided we had to rewrite the whole thing from beginning to end because there was so much material.
We've rewritten almost every sentence of the original book and added so much new material. And we have two more volumes to go. And I said to Barbara at one point, we have to rewrite this book. It can't just be, we can't just correct some errors and add a little bit here and a little bit there.
The language has changed. Your attitudes about language have changed,
yes,
I suspect.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we,
yes.
We were advancing in age, and we thought now's the time. If we're going to do it, we have to do it right now. We'd never be able to have the energy or the strength to do it later.
On the other hand, you had an advantage here. You didn't have young kids to contend with. I understand the first time around your sons came to accept Eugene O'Neill as a member of the family.
That is true.
Because
yes.
You're spending so much time with him.
Yeah. In fact, they were very resentful that we thought Shakespeare was the greatest playwright in the world. They said, what about Eugene O'Neill?
Because he was such a daily member of the family.
Yes.
Well,
you
have to remember too that of Bordeaux that the house became one great library. There were papers piled up to the ceiling in some rooms. We were surrounded, and the kids were surrounded by all these
documents. That was 35 years ago. We never expected to have that same situation again.
There were other things that happened in the old days. Some people who you interviewed told you they didn't want you to reveal certain things.
That's true. That's
so you
true.
had to keep things out of the book?
Yeah. Some, you know, not really major things, but they were things that we now can use. And mainly it was the widow, Carlotta Monterey, who was concealing her papers and a lot of O'Neill's papers. She didn't want anything revealed until after her death.
And first let me tell people that my guests are Arthur and Barbara Gelb, and they have gone back to Eugene O'Neill after 38 years. And the first volume of a projected three-volume biography?
Three-volume and a four-part WGBH series with Rick Burns.
Wow. It's O'Neill, Life with Monte Cristo. We'll find out what that means in a few moments. And the book is published by Applause. So why didn't Carlotta Monterey want these things revealed? By then, Eugene O'Neill was already a towering figure. I don't think anything could have hurt his reputation in theater.
No, it was not so much his reputation as a dramatist as their relationship. She was terribly protective of that because it was not always totally serene. And there were documents, letters, and so on that illustrated the difficulties they had in their marriage. Because, you know, he was not able to write for the last 10 years of his life. He had a nervous degenerative illness. And so he was sort of cooped up by himself with his thoughts and with Carlotta for the last 10 years of his life. And their relationship was anything but serene and happy, and she was protective of that.
They were madly in love when they met, and he used her character in several of his later plays. And it was tragic in a way to see the marriage disintegrate. It ended at a point when he had her committed to a mental institution, and she had wanted him committed to an institution. Finally, they made peace.
That's taking your crazy, no, you're crazy, to the farthest extreme.
Absolutely. It was really unbelievable melodrama at the end.
Yes. His life was more melodramatic in many ways than the tragedies of his plays. It was amazing how dramatic his own life was.
He was a giant as a writer, but he was not totally wonderful as a person.
He was not a very good father.
And he was a difficult husband.
Women who had been in his life wanted to be discreet too.
Yes,
You're talking about Beatrice Ashe, I think. Her letters, which we tried to get her to give us when we did our original biography, she would not tell us anything about them.
That's because this was the early 60s and not the late 60s? You think something happened?
She wanted to keep the letters for her own book.
She thought she was going to write her own book.
And these letters, they're so revealing, and she finally sold them to the New York Public Library.
But this was after our book was published, so, you know.
And those letters are an important part of our book. Our new book, yes.
Well, one of the problems that you face here is that several witnesses to the same event have completely different interpretations. And that's something you had to sort out, too. When we come back, we'll talk about some of that and some of the other problems that a biographer has to face in writing about a man as great as Eugene O'Neill. O'Neill, Life with Monte Cristo, is now available from Applause Books. Arthur and Barbara Gelb have written it. We will continue our conversation right after the news here on AMA 20 WNYC, live online at WNYC.org. Stay with us. We're back with Arthur Gelb, former managing editor of the New York Times. In the 1950s, he was assistant drama critic under Brooks Atkinson and often wrote about cultural matters. Barbara Gelb is the author of So Short a Time, a biography of John Reed and Louise Bryant, the one-character play, My Jean, based on Eugene O'Neill's widow, Carlotta Monterey. Colleen Dewhurst starred in that. She is also a freelance journalist. Together, they have written, and I don't know what to call this, an update, a whole new biography, I guess, of Eugene O'Neill, the first volume of which is O'Neill, Life with Monte Cristo, just out from Applause. This is the first volume, and it is 750 pages long. What does Life with Monte Cristo mean?
Well, it means of his travels with his father.
Who played the Count of Monte Cristo?
Who played the Count of Monte Cristo 5,000 times during his lifetime, crisscrossed the country in a time when, this is the late 19th and early 20th century, when we did not have any television or movies yet, and every and every small town across the country had its theater. The larger towns had three or four theaters, and every actor toured the country and played in their different roles, and that was the entertainment. That was all there was in those days.
Well, actors love, they tell me, to go for a long run in theater. They could learn so much about a character, but I think 5,000 performances, he would have been sleepwalking.
Yes, he was. He finally decided it was too much.
And that's the tragedy of the basic O'Neill tragedy, because his father compromised. He had the ambition to be a Shakespearean actor, and he did so well.
He played with Edwin Booth and other great actors of his day, and he was very, very talented.
He did so brilliantly that Booth himself thought he might be his successor. Booth was the leading Shakespearean actor in the country, and he filled in this role of the Count of Monte Cristo. The actor who was supposed to do it died suddenly. And he was a smash success. He he could never rid himself of the part.
It was really a melodrama based on the Dumas book, and it was so typical of the type of melodramas that were popular in those days, and he had enormous success in it.
And it paid so well, and there you go back to his early life, his fear of poverty, and this made him very comfortable. And every time he tried to go back to a Shakespearean play, the audiences wouldn't hear of it. They wanted him in that role, and he kept playing it over and over and over again. And his son Eugene decided one day that this was ridiculous, and actually formulated his credo, which was never to compromise your artistic vision. That you never stop at success, but you go on to a greater success, or a greater failure, as he called it. And it was only the spiritual middle classes that stopped at success, and how he said how petty their dreams must have been.
Now, he thought first he was going to be an actor himself, didn't he?
His father, in some of his own early plays? His father, in desperation because O'Neill would never get a job of any kind, finally put him into his play two or three times. He performed in small roles. He was terrible as an actor, and he hated it. And he hated his father's theater.
But he had to understand his father's theater that he hated, the old melodramatic theater, in order to overturn it and create the modern American theater.
Now, you say that you are still haunted by one fundamental question, and that's whether O'Neill was a wounded and melancholy figure because of his parents, or whether he used and exaggerated his parents' difficulties to explain or justify his tragic view of life. Have you answered that question for yourselves?
Not really. I think that will never be answered. I think only a new Freud may be able to answer it, but it's a psychiatric question. You just have to make up your own mind about that.
Well, you do have the example of his older brother, who was very self-destructive. Obviously, this was a dysfunctional family in the extreme.
Definitely.
The word didn't exist at that time.
The older brother was the one who became an actor because he had nothing else he could do, and his father finally said, well, you know, you're going to act because I'm not going to support you all my life. He did anyway support him all his life, but the older brother, James, did become an actor.
And how much do we understand about their relationship from looking at a play like Long Day's Journey and Tonight?
He once said himself, too close. They fed on each other's disabilities. And O'Neill's brother, of course, influenced him, took him on the wrong path many times. And then O'Neill himself followed that path. He became an alcoholic. And with great courage, he overcame that. And that enabled him to write his greatest plays. He wrote his greatest plays when he was cold sober.
And to some degree, he actually uses the plays as a way of talking about that rehabilitation. Iceman Cometh and others are all comments on what he's doing in his life.
And he writes about his father and his brother, and of course his mother too. But his relationship with his brother was enormously important. His brother was the saddest of all the O'Neills, I think, because he was a brilliant, brilliant young man, a brilliant student. He was outstanding at school, and he just threw his life away. He just was so, I guess, depressed about his mother and her drug addiction.
He adored his mother, and when he discovered her drug addiction, as O'Neill did when he discovered his mother's drug addiction, fell apart. They both fell apart
in
different ways.
O'Neill managed to overcome it by becoming a writer, and James just threw his life away.
Now, you said that in working on this book, you've changed your attitudes about the father. You've become much more sympathetic toward him. What about Eugene's mother, Ella?
Well, she's really a very, very fascinating character.
She's always been a sympathetic character, at least the way he depicted her.
Up to a point. Well, he didn't depict her all that sympathetically. If you read Long Day's Journey very closely, and if you talk to some of the actresses who have interpreted her, she was really a rather manipulative woman.
Caldwell, for example, felt that way.
And she played her as manipulative, and you can see the manipulativeness in her if you read it carefully. And what we have now, in this new volume, been able to examine some of O'Neill's early scenarios of Long Day's Journey and Tonight. And he was much tougher on her in the early scenarios than
What shocked us that was that he called her in one of the early scenarios an alien demon.
Wow, because she came. Because I remember seeing the original production
with
Florence Eldridge, and
well,
she was a woman just trying to hold it together. Who then had this drug problem?
She had a gentle interpretation of it.
I think the victim was not really quite right.
I don't think it was quite right.
And there was a gentleness to her, but when she was angry and she tried to smother it, and it would come out in some vicious commentary about her sons and
but it's very hard to have a balance about that too, because she had her remissions and she was fine during those periods.
And we discovered in this new version exactly how she got off morphine, which she had been addicted to for so many years. It was going back to the church, and a church in Brooklyn managed to bring her back into the arms of the church.
After having gone to all kinds of sanitariums and been given all kinds of treatments that never worked. Mm-hmm.
She'd been given too much morphine to overcome some painful... Her pregnancy, was it?
No, after the birth
of Eugene O'Neill. She was in a terrible depression when O'Neill was born. He was born in a hotel on 43rd Street and Broadway. We're about to put up a plaque there to mark the spot. And... she was so depressed, and she had a painful birth. O'Neill was a 10-pound baby, and he and
he was a 10-pound playwright, baby.
20-pound playwright.
The hotel doctor gave her morphine, and it made her feel wonderful, and she just kept on taking it.
What a weight for a kid to carry! Yes. My mother became a drug addict,
and she let him know it.
She let him know it time and time again.
My guests are Arthur and Barbara Gelb. They're latest collaboration is a new biography of Eugene O'Neill, replacing the one they wrote in the 60s. It's called O'Neill, Life with Monte Cristo from Applause Books. Actually, this is just the first of three volumes. You learned a lot about his relationships with women. Have you changed your opinions about how he related to women there as well? And how important an influence was his mother on the kinds of women he was attracted to?
Oh, tremendously important influence, because he was always looking for the mother that he felt he didn't have, because she was so remote. And because of her drug addiction, she did not give him the sort of love that he thought he should have. And he was always looking for a motherly woman.
Mm-hmm. And so was his brother. In Mumford and Spigotten, he's looking for a woman with a full-breasted woman, he mentions this in the play over and over again.
Breasts are very important to O'Neill. Is that okay to say?
Absolutely.
Anyway, the letters that we have...
We must know these things.
Yes. The letters that we found for this new volume that we did not have for our original volume with one of his early girlfriends, Beatrice Ashe, are enormously important as a clue to his relationships with women.
In every relationship, he writes to the woman he is at that point in love with, "I need you, I need you, I need you.
Be my mother.
Be my mother, I need you." It's kind of pathetic.
Let me put my hands on your breasts.
Hands too, probably, but he didn't say that.
Yeah. But some of the letters are very...
A little pornographic.
I'm really passionate, yes.
Has working on this biography, again, affected your evaluation of him as a playwright? Because I think people are still ambivalent about him.
He stands taller than ever before. You know, in this era, when we are exhorted to revere our pop culture icons, we've shrunk our heroes, O'Neill is, with his vision, with his integrity, with his courage in the face of defeat, his idealism, he really stands out. You know, he once said that an artist must soar always. He should never stop at success. He has to go on to a greater success, or what he termed a greater failure.
Well, what do you think about the production of Moon for the Misbegotten now?
Oh, I thought it was a very good production. My favorite production, I think, will stand as the greatest, will be the one that Jason Robards and Colleen Dewhurst did. But you can't freeze a play in that kind of way. It would never be revived again. I think Cherry Jones and Byrne did a terrific job. And it will be done over the years many times.
You know, we could have stopped ever doing Hamlet after Edwin Booth played Hamlet.
No, well, I wasn't suggesting that we stop doing it, but you suggested that Florence Eldridge didn't get it right, and it was good that there were later productions.
Right.
As great as Florence Eldridge was, is Moon for the Misbegotten also autobiographical on some level?
Very much so.
Completely. Well, it is up to a point, that is. It's about his brother. And about mother's death and what his brother did when the mother died. What is not autobiographical, what is totally imaginary, is the creation of this woman, Josie Hogan, who gives Jamie his final absolution, which O'Neill felt he had to do because Jamie died unabsolved and miserable, feeling that he had betrayed his mother. So this was a kind of compassionate thing of O'Neill's to do.
Where will the next volume take up?
The next volume ends with his first marriage and his My first marriage was really not a marriage. It lasted just a very short time. His second marriage, the mother of Una O'Neill.
The birth of his two children.
Two children. And it ends with his meeting Carlotta Monterey.
And it also ends with his writing Strange Interlude, which was the greatest commercial success that he ever had at that point.
And one of the plays that is produced more infrequently than
It's a very difficult play to produce. It's done every once in a while by some brave actors, but it's very difficult.
Just one more question. This from a listener. He wants to know, Sean from Brooklyn wants to know, what should he do with the first biography? Just throw it out?
No.
Oh, absolutely not.
I think the first biography we still stand by it. It's a terrific work, we feel, but we're going beyond it.
And you want him to buy this one, too?
I want him,
oh,
yes.
Of course,
I think he will find much more information, much more detail than in the first book.
And when will the Ken Burns show be on PBS?
Rick Burns.
Rick Burns. We're working on it now. We've written part of our treatment. And
probably 2 years from now it will be done.
We're not sure. Totally. Maybe sooner than that. We're not sure yet.
I want to thank you both for being with us today, Arthur and Barbara Gelb. O'Neill, Life with Monte Cristo is published by Applause Books. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Only a few plays deserve being called masterpieces. Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Tonight is definitely one of them. If you've never seen it, or even if you have, there's a stunning new revival of it starring Jessica Lange, Gabriel Byrne, and Michael Shannon as the troubled, gifted Tyrone family, currently at the Roundabouts American Airlines Theater on 42nd Street. It's garnered 7 Tony nominations, and it's only running through June 26th, so I'm especially pleased to welcome back to our show these three very talented actors. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Jessica, weren't you in a production of it in London in 2000?
Yes. I mean, it was a part, you know, that I've always wanted to do, and the producer asked me if I would do it, and I said yes, of course, and we did the production there. And then when we finished, I always wanted to do it again because it's one of those roles that you can come back to.
Did you feel it was kind of unresolved?
Well, no, I mean, I liked the production, and I felt, you know, that work at that time was what I wanted it to be. But I also knew that there was much more to find in it, you know, because we were just talking earlier. I mean, every night you go on stage, there's something that you discover, no matter how many times you've played it. You know, you never come to the bottom of this, and suddenly you say a line and you realize, oh, that's the connection. Mm-hmm. That's what, and it's endlessly fascinating.
This is obviously a rich play for actors because you probably can find so many different things in it. Eugene O'Neill wrote wonderful dialogue, but
it's my sense that, having seen a number of productions, that you can play these roles very differently.
Mm-hmm.
And you've come back to this one 16 years later.
Yes, and I think it's a very different performance. I mean, and that's, you know, because of the director, because of the other actors, because of where I am at my life at this, in my life at this moment. So, yes, I would say it's endlessly, the possibilities are endless.
Gabriel, you've been in a number of O'Neill dramas, played Jamie Tyrone in A Moon for the Misbegotten, and you also in A Touch of the Poet. Were they good preparation for appearing in this massive work?
quite honestly, no. Because I think that each one has its own challenges in very unpredictable ways. And I also feel that each performance, never mind each play, is an entity in and of itself, because what you did last night doesn't really matter. It's what you do tonight, and that's the gift, I suppose, of live theatre. I think that, as Jessica says, I think that you reach a stage in life, I think, where you have an empathy for the suffering of these people. And although they are, as he said himself, haunted characters, O'Neill brings tremendous compassion to their suffering.
And a lot of complexity.
And complexity as well.
So do you think that playing O'Neill is kind of like doing Shakespeare, because each play is a thing you can't say, well, okay, I'm in Shakespeare territory?
Well, I don't mean this to sound pretentious, but I think that Shakespeare helps you very much with iambic pentameter, and you can kind of float over the rhythms and the language. But O'Neill demands a commitment, an emotional commitment each night. That is certainly true, obviously, in Shakespeare, but nothing quite like the depth that you're required to go to with O'Neill.
Michael, is this your first venture into O'Neill territory?
Yes, it is. I was just thinking about what Gabriel said and what you asked him, and I think the interesting thing about O'Neill is that, in a sense, he was a playwright almost begrudgingly sometimes. He was very fond, obviously, of poetry and also of literature, and I think there were days where he... Don't take a picture of me. There were days where he...
This is radio. Nobody knows, Michael.
There were days where he kind of wished he was probably writing a novel, because he was so interested in getting into the interior life of these people. And it's important to realize, in the history of American drama, that he was the first playwright to delve so deeply into human behavior and to not be afraid to put lines of dialogue into the play that are beyond maybe what you would say in a natural, realistic conversation.
And yet, simply for the sake, it feels realistic.
Well, yeah, but simply for the sake of exploring the depths of the particular character that he's writing about.
He mentioned Shakespeare, but what about Chekhov, something like Uncle Vanya?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, Vanya, I had the great pleasure of doing that play a few years back here. And another writer who is not afraid to delve as deeply as possible into human behavior. Perhaps with a little bit more humor, although we've discovered since we've opened that this is actually quite a funny play, apparently, sometimes, which was kind of a shock to all of us. But I guess it's the laughter of recognition, probably. Yeah.
Well, also, as we discover these characters and we know them better, when they say certain things, when we catch them in lies, when we catch them in self-delusion, it's quite funny.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, it is interesting. And well, it's interesting because the whole thing is kind of, you know, these people, they love each other very much, but in a way it's kind of like four different opponents, and watching these opponents figure out different ways to wrestle with one another and try and knock the other one off their horse. There's a certain kind of existential glee in that, I suppose.
Now, Michael said that he thought maybe O'Neill wrote it to be read. Why do you think he didn't want it published until 25 years after his death? Well, he wrote a whole bunch of plays after this, didn't he?
A couple plays, yeah. Well, I think it was because of the family members and who was still alive and who would, I mean, because I was reading one account about the original New York production, and they determined at that time that the only, you know, there were two surviving children or something, but he had nothing to do with those children by the time he had died, so... I think that was one way of kind of, you know, excusing themselves for doing the production. But I think, wasn't it originally that he didn't want it done while family members were still alive?
So this is a very autobiographical play.
Yeah, yeah. I think he was worried about perhaps, you know, revealing too much, you know, of people that were still, you know, close to him.
It's a difficult one because on the one hand, it requires tremendous courage to write a play like that. On the other hand, you are revealing the great faults and weaknesses of those people who are members of your family. So he must have felt a great deal of guilt and shame, too, about using this family.
Mm-hmm.
For his own ends as a dramatist. But by doing that, paradoxically, he managed to give a family that's universally prototypical and identifiable. Because, as you were pointing out, you know, you come to this and you see your own mother, your father, your brothers and sisters, because he has so beautifully constructed the complex dynamic of what it means to be in a family where everybody has the mask off and everybody is telling each other the truth.
Have you researched the O'Neill story? Do we know what kind of actor his father really was?
His father was... there's actually some footage of his father performing the play that destroyed him, The Count of Monte Cristo.
It destroyed him because it be such a hit that he just got stuck with playing it. At least this is what he says in Long Day's Journey.
Yeah. Well, actually, the last thing that O'Neill's father said to him was, and I'm paraphrasing here, whatever you do, never sell out, because that's what he did with his life. And if you look at the footage, of course, it belongs to another time and another era. In 1916, I think they recorded it. But it looks like he was a woeful ham bone altogether.
My guests are Gabriel Byrne, who plays James Tyrone, Michael Shannon, who plays James Tyrone Jr., and Jessica Lange, who plays Mary Tyrone, in a new production of Long Day's Journey and Tonight, now at the Roundabout's American Airlines Theater on West 42nd Street, unfortunately with a very limited run, just until June 26. Now, Jessica's been in it before, but Gabriel and Michael, had either of you read or seen other productions of the play before you signed on for this production?
I had only seen the film, and I saw the film quite a long time ago. I remember being completely knocked out by it, thinking it was, you know, some of the greatest acting I had seen up until that point.
Catherine Hepburn
and of course Jason Robards, who kind of owns this role, you know.
And Sir Ralph Richardson.
Ralph Richardson and Dean Stockwell played Edmund. Mm-hmm.
But that film, directed by Sidney Lumet, mm-hmm. is a great film, but it runs under 2 hours.
Yes,
and the play runs almost... what, 3.5 hours?
Right. And there's been, yeah, substantial editing in the film. There's also been a bit in our production not quite as much, but I would have been. It would have been hard for me. I when I see things, they really make quite an impression on me, and it would have been hard to do it had I seen it on stage before. I think.
Although your interpretation is very different than Jason Robards.
You know, people say that, and sometimes I've even heard people say that it seems as if I'm trying to reinvent the part. But I swear on a stack of Bibles, all I've been doing is reading the play and taking my cues from what seems to be on the page. I never went into it thinking, oh, I'm going to razzle-dazzle everybody with my completely innovative approach to Jamie. It just kind of, I guess the one thing people say is it's not usually so physical at the end. But I think by that point, you know, almost 3 hours and 15 minutes into the play, if I just came out and sat in a chair, someone might throw a tomato at me or something. So I figure I have a little onus to kind of shake things up, you know.
Well, you play James Tyrone Jr. Very physically.
Yeah.
We learn an awful lot about the character from body language, from the piercing eyes.
Well, I take that cue from, you know, early on in the play, Papa calls me a healthy Hulk. And I think Jamie is very physical. Eugene O'Neill was very physical. He was a swimmer, could swim all day long in the ocean. He was a sailor. I mean, he did these things that were strenuous physically. And Jamie, I think, also was, I think it was in the blood, you know. I think they were a sturdy clan of people.
This whole thing about reinterpreting a part that somebody else has done earlier has come up before when I've talked to actors. And many of them say that they would prefer not to have seen earlier performances. But does it really matter, as Michael points out, when you get the script, do you just simply see the role as it best suits you?
Well, I mean, I have not seen any stage productions of this play, which I'm glad I haven't.
And you say you came home after appearing in it the other night, and it was on television,
yes,
and you saw the final scene.
I did. I watched Act 4. But, you know, I had seen the film, like Michael, many, many, many years before. Did not see it recently, except for the other night. But I watched it only because I'm not in Act 4, so I thought, well, I'll watch what the boys are doing. but, you know, I think there's... this play, I think more than anything I've ever done, it has an energy that it's inescapable in a way. And you start, and it just kind of, I don't know, it pushes you somewhere that you didn't even know necessarily you were going to go there. And it kind of creates the character. From my own experience, I never sat down and said, well, this is how I'd like to play this moment. This is how I want to play this moment. Then I think I should go here. You know, it never had that kind of choreography to it. I never thought in those terms. It was just like you started, and there was something that, like, drew you in and kind of pushed you to where each of these moments were going, and it had a life of its own in a way. So for me, that's how the performance was shaped.
And the writing is so brilliant that even though it is 3.5 hours, it never sags. You never think, oh, he should have edited that down. I'm assuming that that's also what propels the actors.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's opinions across the board on that. Some people do, you know, kvetch about it a little bit, but
not going to hear me kvetch. No, I think it's probably the greatest American play.
I do too.
I think what's really kind of capturing you when you walk out on stage are the ghosts of these people. You know, it never fails to dawn on me at some point during the show that I'm basically playing someone who was actually here, and I always take that responsibility very seriously. Not that I think Jamie Tyrone really gives a flying toot what I do every night. But nonetheless, in this particular circumstance, I'm a surrogate. But it's a very interesting phenomenon, because you would think when you're getting ready to do this play, you would, you know, go to a quiet place and, you know, think really serious thoughts and get yourself all geared up for it. But when we're backstage right before the show starts, there's always kind of this giddy energy, you know. There's someone cracks a joke, we chuckle, we kind of, I mean, that's literally how the show starts, as per instructions of the director, is that we're supposed to sit around the table and laugh. And it's so fascinating to me that we enter into this in almost kind of a very pedestrian sort of way, and like 5 or 10 minutes into it, it's taken over. The play has taken over, and it's almost irrelevant, you know, where we were, what we were doing.
I have to go to a little break, but we'll return to my guests, Michael Shannon, Gabriel Byrne, and Jessica Lange, currently in the Roundabout Theater Company's production of Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Into Night, which is running until just June 26th at the American Airlines Theater. If you want ticket information, you can go to our show page at wmyc.org/lopate. We're back with Jessica Lange, a 2 Academy and 3 Emmy Award winner, who's playing Mary Tyrone in the Roundabout Theater Company's production of Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Into Night. Gabriel Byrne plays her husband, James Tyrone, and Michael Shannon plays their son, James Tyrone Jr. We also have a couple of other cast members, and a brilliant performance of the other son as well. We just can't fit 4 people into the studio, so we had to. We couldn't get everybody in here. It is, as we pointed out, a very long play, running 3.5 hours. Do you feel that length, or is there kind of a relentless drive toward the climax at the end?
Well, I think there is a relentless drive. I mean, it does, you know, no matter how exhausted you are, you know, when you step on stage, there is something, because you think to yourself, oh, I can't do it. I just don't have the energy. It's just going to go on and on. It's like, I don't think I can. And then something else happens, and it's almost like alchemy. There's like an exchange of energy, and something, I don't know, something takes over. And you do it. You know, it's not, every night isn't the same, thank God. And it's great working with these actors, because everything is moving all the time. And it's, you know, it has new life.
So do you give each other different lines?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Read, I hate to say line reads, because...
Yeah, no, but I think there is. There's something, and it's also part of that thing we were just talking about, like that discovery, that there's constant discovery happening, you know, throughout the play every night. So it shades it in one way or another. There are, you know, I mean, 3.5 hours. I was reading something about the original production, and Theodore Mann, who produced it for Circle in the Square, said that, you know, he talked about the 3.5 hour play. So whatever they did, you know, I mean, that's kind of the running time. I mean, I'm sure everybody has trimmed here and there as they've gone along. But, you know, I think with this play, there is something, I mean, it's such a brilliant play, and I think it's kind of the mother lode of all family plays that came afterward.
It's very intimate, a family that embraces and then turns on someone, and then they're back again, hugging each other. Do you at times, because of the intimacy, start feeling like you are the Tyrones?
I think we have a very strong affection for one another. I mean, I think part of this energy that gets created is the quartet nature of the piece, that we are constantly pushing one another to keep going. You know, it'd be one thing if It was a 3.5-hour monologue, you know. But some of my favorite scenes in the play, and there's not many of them, but is when all four of us are on stage together. It's just so fascinating to see, you know, how the four of us inhabit that room.
Actually, there are quite a few, I think.
Well, it kind of not descends, but it kind of dissolves into more kind of two-handed scenes, particularly in the second act.
Is it tricky playing someone who's switching back and forth, lying to himself and to the people that he or she loves, and then suddenly being brutally honest?
Well, I think O'Neill is brutally honest as a writer. And I think that he demands of those characters that he writes an honesty and a truth.
But they're also actors. Two of them are actors, and sometimes they seem to just be acting out.
Yeah, but the thing is that I've never believed that actors are actors in real life, you know. In fact, I would believe the opposite, is that most people act 98% of the time. It's only in rare situations where we confront the truth in ourselves and in each other, and one of those places is in a drama. And I think if you made a word count of the amount of times that the word lie is mentioned in the play, it would be maybe 20 times it's mentioned. And truth is relative. It's not absolute. So do you believe James Tyrone when he says that he really did not do the things that he's accused of? Or do you believe Mary? Or do you believe Jamie? Because the truth is fractured, and it's up to you as a member of the audience to say, I believe it or I don't believe it. But they believe it. That's what's interesting.
We see that in a scene where you're justifying to Edmund, played by John Gallagher Jr., why you're sending him to an inexpensive sanitarium, and you tell him about the hard poverty of your childhood. James is both honest, and at the same time, he's playing Edmund.
I don't think of it like that, because he does say to him, it's the best place for you. Both those doctors recommended it is the best place. And, you know, they say...
But I, as a member of the audience, wasn't so sure that it was the best place for him.
That's good. Because, as I said, James Tyrone believes that, but you as a member of the audience may not.
And Michael, your character doesn't believe it either.
Well, yeah, I mean, my character's mind is like a wheel of fortune that never stops spinning. I mean, he's all over the place. I don't think he even really knows. I don't think he has a great sense of his own identity, really. I think he's kind of surrendered to this notion that he's dead weight. And he's kind of put that yoke on his shoulders, and yet he has such a vital and agile mind. So it's such a strange dichotomy between someone who's a loafer, you know, a failure, and yet kind of a genius.
O'Neill tells us he was good at school.
Yeah, he was very bright. You know, it's very moving. In the research materials we compiled, there's a poem that Jamie wrote when he was still in school, when he was a boy, because the chancellor of this particular boarding school he was going to had passed away, and he wrote it in honor of his memory. And it's a startlingly beautiful poem, and I read it from time to time and think about that in relation to doing, you know, the play, to just see the scope of how far he's deteriorated. But it's interesting. One thing I wanted to say earlier is one of my favorite playwrights is Eugene Ionesco, and he says every story is a detective story. And it was interesting the way you were talking about the play with Gabriel. It really is a detective story, and you, the audience, are the detective. we did an interview with the New York Times, and the woman said, well, what's wrong with his family? And I said, well, I wouldn't want to answer that question for you. Then what's the experience of watching the play for you about? You know, I think everybody who comes, I think they should be sitting there thinking, what's really wrong with these people? You know?
But they all seem to blame each other for their problems, or other things for their problems. Jessica, do you think that Mary feels that she bears any of the fault for becoming the way she's become?
Well, I think, you know, there's that thing, I mean, which we haven't talked about here yet today, is addiction. And, I mean, every one of these people, the four family members, are addicted to something, whether it's alcohol, whether it's morphine. So you have that that's thrown into this family dynamic, which completely turns it on its head, because there's nothing rational in there. I mean, Mary, you know, talk about a detective story. I mean, you know, we had to decide, and I read the text again and again, and, you know, when does Mary actually start using again? And the few things that she says and the few things that the boys have noticed indicate that she started that night. So I enter into this with this horrific secret, you know, and I always find it very interesting playing a character who's harboring this secret, and to try to keep that, and yet at the same time you think, how can she be so nuts? Because how can they not know? Does she actually think that she can just go upstairs and chip away at morphine for, you know, the next couple weeks or months and nobody's going to notice this? So it has this kind of strange, already this weird dynamic entering into the, you know, as soon as we step on stage, because I know I've started again. I'm trying to hide it from them.
But everybody in this family is stoned at one point.
Oh,
or
no, absolutely. And that, I think Mary makes that point over and over again. You know, yes, I may be a morphine addict, but you're drunk again tonight. You're getting drunk and going to the hooker shop. It's like nobody gets off free here. So it is, it's about blame. It's about recrimination. It's about, you know, guilt and all these things. But in Mary's mind, to answer your question, no, I think she really does feel that she was victimized in this situation, that she had a horrific birth, she was in terrible pain, as she keeps mentioning to James over in some cheap hotel quack of a doctor, started her on morphine. And you see this kind of opiate, you know, epidemic that's happening in this country now. I'm sure a lot of those people that were prescribed, you know, painkiller medicine, I mean, just today, you know, they released the autopsy report of Prince. And it's like, how do these people start on this? They're given it by a doctor.
And he led a very clean life.
Other than that, yeah. I mean, so, you know, I think it is, it's very relevant. I mean, every night I get on stage and I start ranting about doctors, I think, aha, doctors prescribed this to me. You know, it feels very, very current in a way.
The play is only running until June 20. Six, is it? And then you're moving on to other things. What are you going to be doing, Gabriel?
A couple of things, but you know,
you have some movies coming out.
Yeah, I don't. I'm more content to just get to the 26th of June, and then.
And this can't go on any longer. You all.
I don't think so. I don't think so. What we were talking about, and which I would really love to do, is to film it, because I don't think there's been a film of it for a very long time.
Too bad Louis Malle isn't around to do this, what he did for Uncle Vanya.
Yeah, pity Louis Malle isn't here, full stop. But I think, I think there's no way that you can think about really anything else. Myself and Jessica were just talking about, like, when you get in at nighttime, it's so, I don't know, hard to kind of come down from the play or get away from it or just get it out of your head that you end up watching The Housewives of New York or something, trying to clear your brain, and then you get caught up in that.
We have to end it here, unfortunately, but it's been my great pleasure to be speaking with Gabriel Byrne, Jessica Lange, Michael Shannon, three of the stars of the Roundabout Theatre Company's new production of Eugene O'Neill's great play, Long Day's Journey Into Night, which is running only into June 26 at the American Airlines Theatre. That's on West 42nd Street. Ticket information on our show page at wmyc.org/lopate.